Well, good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and this is SCARS, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SCARS organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 in Good Amateur Practice. This SCARS server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by Kilo Bravo 8 Zulu Golf Lima. And all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they've checked in. Information regarding our operation may be found at SCARS VOIP, that's spelled SCARSVOIP.com. Your net controls this session are actually, I believe, two or more. It's KY6Z, W4RFJ, and I'm hoping that KC2GA will be there as well. My name is Kathy. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. And my location is Port St. Lucie, Florida, where it's currently a temperature of 82 degrees. We had a high of 85. I don't know. We may have some storms later on. So prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled. If so, please come aboard. There ain't no emergency traffic, and that's always a great thing. How about anyone celebrating a birthday, either this week or maybe this upcoming week, that would like to come aboard so we could say happy, happy birthday? All right, no birthdays either. That means you and I and everyone connected tonight are just not getting any older. This is the monthly Thursday Informational Net Open Forum, or TIN for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. Now let me advise all stations connected that this net will be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast. All stations participating will definitely be part of that recording. Once again, our program tonight is about antennas. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to the masters tonight. I'll be listening in the background. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. KY6V, are you ready to take over?
I think so. Thanks, Kathy. Good evening, everybody. Gordon here, KY6V, and welcome to the October TIN. And as Kathy mentioned, we're going to be talking about antennas tonight. We'll do a little chatting about HF, VHF, and UHF antennas. And I will say that it's not going to be overly technical. What we're trying to do is impart some thinking processes for everybody to understand and think about when you're going about in designing or putting up an antenna. So what we're going to do is start with the basics and suggest that you analyze your need and what you want to accomplish. I think that makes a good starting point. Let me buy a nickel here to get the clock running properly. Now, first, as a general rule, please remember that one of the most popular and very effective antennas is the half-wave dipole. And if you are considering the upper HF band, such as 20 through 10 meters, you may wish to consider a rotating beam antenna. And although the dipole works fine at these frequencies, the beam gives you more gain, signal strength, along with front-to-back selectivity. Seem to be hearing the question, if I have a small lot, what considerations must I make for antennas, such as loaded antennas, inverted V's or something of the like? And the answer to that is everything is a compromise that is under a full-size antenna, at least one half wave above ground and further not folded or bent from a pure horizontal plane. Excuse me. This precludes vertical antennas, of course. And loaded antennas use a combination of inductance and capacitance to resonate the overall system to something less than a half or full wave antenna. In doing so, the full radiation is limited by the insertion of this device, and in the case of an inverted V, if the angle of the slope is not made to be too tight, not more than any more than probably 120 degrees, this antenna will function rather well, but its pattern of radiation will be altered and will not compare in all overall performance to a straight dipole. Let me buy a nickel. So moving this on, consideration in what bands you plan to work are somewhat needed. By knowing this information, we'll narrow your selections of antennas you might choose to use. Bear in mind that your best choice is an antenna cut and resonant at your preferred operating frequency, and we'll talk about resonance and some of that stuff a little later into the program. One of the other questions I hear is if space for antennas is an issue for me, will a vertical antenna work as well as a horizontal? Now, that's a good question. And my answer normally is maybe yes and maybe no. We are talking about an HF operation primarily here, and this depends on your ground connectivity, whether or not you're using ground radials and so on. So remember that a vertical antenna on HF produces a very low angle of radiation and therefore very good for DX operation, but does not operate well for short skip type conditions. I want to go into monoband and multiband antenna considerations here for a moment. Although a monoband antenna has been proven to work the best, many multiple multiband antennas work very well. They will not perform on the higher HF bands as well as a beam antenna, but as a second antenna, or your only choice at the moment, will perform satisfactorily for you. The choices out there are many. There's trapped antennas and ZEP-type designed antennas, G5 RV antennas, along with long wires cut to half-wave increments, etc. This really comes down to the room you have for antenna construction and the ability to get it hanging in the air. So another question that we hear is why are multiband antennas less effective than a standard resonant dipole? And the answer is this depends on the type of multiband antenna you're using. In all cases, they are inferior to varying degrees. The trap type antenna are probably the most effective due to the fact that they do not reduce the overall length of the antenna much. The loaded type, which uses inductance and capacitance to gain resonance, reduces the overall length of the antenna and reduces efficiency because of that. Those that work on the second, third, and fourth harmonic principles are adequate, but cannot perform as well as a band-specific cut antenna. Antennas such as the G5RV and the like vary so dramatically in impedance that an antenna tuner is necessary to compromise for the great impedance changes that exist from band to band. Let me buy another nickel. I want to move in for a moment and talk about, and this is KY6V, and this is the South Cars TIN for October. We're talking about antennas. I want to touch for a moment on optimizing your fixed antenna field intensity, if I may. And I would start by saying here that in the case of a beam, this requirement is automatic. But in the case of a dipole or a multiband antenna, this becomes a consideration you should think about. In the case of the dipole or multiband, remember that the maximum radiation comes from the side of the antenna. This means, for example, if you are located in the middle of the United States and wish to work both the West Coast and the East Coast, your antenna should be oriented north and south. Long wires are a horse of a different color. The longer they are as to wavelength, the more the signal is focused to the end of the antenna. So, and this is primarily the end opposite to the feed point, I might add. So when constructing this type of antenna, attempt to point it in the direction that you prefer to work. Other questions that I hear from time to time, can you explain more how long wires can exhibit gain and why we need to point a dipole opposite to the direction we want to work? And in the case of long wires, it depends on how many half waves or wavelengths your antenna is at the operating frequency you are using. When each added half wave, the rated radiated energy that is normally projected off the side of the antenna is drawn to the parallel axis of the wire itself. This being the case, when you get out to eight or so half waves in length, the antenna pattern is strongest off the end of the wire. In the case of a dipole, maximum radiation, as mentioned, occurs off the broad side of the antenna, and this end produces radiated energy, but normally, the ends I'm talking about here, radiated energy, but normally about a half of that which you get off the side. So if you orient the antenna to be broadside to the direction that you wish to work, your better chance of meeting your needs. So that's the opening here from us. And again, this is KY6V. I'm just resetting the timers. I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments. What we'd like to hear from the group this evening, if possible, is anything you'd like to talk about regarding antennas, such as what is your favorite antenna? What have you had the best luck with? What kind of problems have you been able to succumb to, et cetera, et cetera. This is a two-way street tonight. We're not going to be doing all the talking. We'd like to hear from you guys, too. So anybody would like to check in at the moment? And after picking up anybody that would like to join us, I'm going to turn it over to Roger for the next segment. KY6V, looking for any comments?
Romeo Foxtrot Juliet.
7 Ocean.
2GA.
Hey, that's a nice group. I know all you guys, too. Great. RFJ, 7 Ocean, and 2 Golf Alpha. RFJ, my partner in crime tonight. Go ahead, Ron.
Hey, good evening there, Captain. This is W4RFJ, and I would like to add... We're talking about antennas and capacitance and reactants and all that stuff, transmission lines. But, you know, if you could tune up a wet noodle and propagate with it, you know, propagation is probably another factor that we should probably discuss a little bit. You know, that low angle of radiation from a vertical antenna can't be met by a dipole as far as the angle, but at the same time, you know, you've got other ways of mounting your dipole to get you that more local, what they call a low angle of radiation to get into more local stuff than DX. So, and my favorite antenna is a J-pole, but I don't have any working on HF. Let's see, the other one I like is the Wyndham, the Carolina Wyndham or the off-center fed. There's a lot of theory behind that that I find intriguing. And that's all I got. Back over to you, shipmate, W4RFJ.
Well, very good. Roger that, Roger. KY6V. I was sitting back smiling about your comments of the low angle of radiation. You know, to put a pun in front of everybody here, the lower angle of radiation is also met by the higher the antenna is from ground. So think about that one. 7 Oscar. Too early for slinkies, I think, at the moment anyway. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hey, Gordon. Yeah, well, that question is in queue for later. KY6V and the TIN and 070. Please, Gordon, would you describe the visible characteristics of the ZEP antenna you mentioned? KY6V and 070. Over.
Yeah, I'm sorry I got distracted. Which antenna did you want me to comment on?
I'm wondering about the visible characteristics of the ZEP antenna that you mentioned in the intro. Please, Gordon, thanks. And 070.
Okay. Well, the ZEP antenna is an interesting antenna. It comes in a number of configurations on how you actually feed it. It got very popular in World War II, I might add. An N-fed ZEP, sometimes called a Marconi antenna, was a trailing wire coming off of some of these B-25s and other aircraft that were flying in combat missions. You also have ZEP antennas that can pretty well work multi-band type operation. There's off-center fed ZEPs, center-fed ZEPs. They are normally run with open wire feeders, 450 ohms just about most of the time, sometimes 600 ohms. And the combination of the feeders and the antenna makes the whole ball game work. Does that give you enough information for starters, George? Over.
It sure does. Thank you. I find the also the open wire feed informative. Thank you, sir. KY6V and 070.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about it tonight, too, but you know, the G5RV HF antenna is quite popular. Uses a combination of open wire feed and coax. There's some tricks to that feed line that you can work with a G5RV that really makes it sing. All right, let me point the abode up here to Syracuse, New York, and say good evening to our assistant net manager for Southcars. Gary, how art thou?
Well, hello there, Gordon, and hello, everybody, and I are fine, doing well, very busy around the house and with school, but that's a good thing, you know, that's really a good thing. But great to be here today, and this is a great subject. Couple of things. One thing is that, you know, here I am right in the middle of the city, and I think a lot of people are in that same boat. And for years, you know, I've been trying to find an effective antenna for HF. You know, UHF and VHF are very easy things to, you know, come up with a solution in an urban area. But when you're talking HF, that's a whole different thing. I was going to mention the Slinky too, but I guess we're going to wait till the end of the net for that, or later on in the net anyway. But one thing that's worked very well for me is a rotatable dipole, which is, I use a Comet CHV-5X, which is a multi-band 40 through 6 rotatable dipole. And also, and probably even better for DX, this is going to be my second antenna, is a magnetic loop. I used one for years. I took it offline because we had some problems with bees nests in the tuning, but got that all fixed up, and that's been a real good one for me. So before I bite the bullet here. I'm going to go back to the net. This is KC2GA.
Okay, well, very good, Gary. Let me ask you a question on the rotated dipole. How long is that antenna, just the elements itself? Over.
Well, it's not very big at all. The elements, the longest element, which obviously would be the 440, I'm going to say, oh gosh, 18 feet, maybe something like that. It is in the form of a V, not an inverted V, but a V. You've got multiple elements in a V, two basic branches, you know, two sides. There's a dipole, and then you have multiple elements off the end of this V. It looks like they look like fingers. So you know, from the tip of the 40 meter finger to the base of the antenna, I'm just guessing, but I'm gonna say maybe 18 feet. Per side, but it's kind of hard to tell because of the V. Back to you. This is KC2GA.
Yeah, okay. And I assume it's got loading coils in it or traps or something?
Correct. They're coils on the at the end before they feed up into that finger. But that has been a remarkably good antenna for you know, such a small footprint. It's and the beauty of it is, I mean, first of all, I mean, now the compromise, of course, everything's compromised, right? So, you know, I don't get all of 40, you know, so I've got it resonated for the voice part of 40. But I do get, you know, the voice part of 40 through 6, and I do work a lot of 6 meters. So, you know, that's pretty darn good. And I've got just, you know, everything in between but the WARC bins. But that's where my loop comes in, because I'll be able to pick up the WARC and all of 40 and work down through 15 on that. So, you know, you can have, and that's the beauty of having two relatively efficient, certainly the loop is efficient, that's for sure, but two effective small antennas in a small lot situation. Because even with the two of them, you're not taking up a whole lot of space, and you can get a lot of versatility in them.
Okay, very good. Well, I'll have to look that baby up. You know what it sounds to me like? For those that remember the Hustler HF Mobile antenna, it had the main mass, but in addition to that, it had these fingers that came out, and at the bottom of each finger where it attached to the mast, there was a loading coil for the particular band that it was concentrating on. So you put two of those together and put it horizontal and rotate the baby. Maybe that's what happened. Thanks, Gary. Okay, guys and gals, we're going into section two here on antennas for the evening, and that's going to be parlayed by Chief up there in Pennsylvania. So go for it, sir. W4RFJ, KY6V in the group.
All righty. Thank you, Gordon. KY6V with the South Cars Thursday Information Net. This is W4RFJ, and I guess one of the areas that we need to drift into is how VHF and UHF antennas should be considered as opposed to HF. Now, Gordon, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to ad-lib a little bit along with the script that you sent me, if you don't mind. Is that okay?
Well, I would expect nothing less. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, very good. Just reading through the script over the week, it's brought to mind some thoughts that may or may not help as far as, you know, determining what kind of antenna you want to put up. And you did bring up a very neat configuration for those Hustler mobile mounts. They actually make a mount where you can turn those mobile mounts into a dipole. Well, the one thing that we got to keep in mind is that an antenna and its feed line is an antenna and its feed line, whether it's on HF or VHF or UHF. Where the difference starts to come into play is when you move into the higher frequencies, the antenna does become smaller and easier to work with, but the loss factor in your transmission line becomes very significant as you move higher in frequency. This situation we'll be talking about here shortly. So, question, this may be premature to your statement covered later, but what causes coax to become less effective at a higher frequency? Hold on a second. Well, as everybody knows, antennas and wire deal with inductance and capacitance and frequency. And the reactance or the overall impedance of that specific circuit is going to be determined by the frequency and the capacitive reactance and the inductive reactance. But to keep things simple, the dielectric of the coax, being poly, foam, or air, or whatever, has a capacitive effect between the center conductor and that of the shield. This capacitive effect increases with frequency and creates losses in your power delivery from point A to B, or from one end of the transmission line to the other. And it becomes very predominant in the higher frequencies. That's why a lot of the military go to waveguide, because it has a less capacitive effect. But the losses involved are directly related to the dielectric being used, the diameter of the cable, the length of the cable, the frequency that you're using. It all kind of like comes together as an impedance. So let me grab a nickel. Sorry about that. I scrolled off the page. this is W4RFJ. So the next thing that we think about is, you know, what kind of coverage do you want? You know, we're talking about VHF and UHF here. Do you want local omni coverage, or do you want to reach out and really touch someone, as the captain put in the script? You know, that can be done in a lot of different ways. So you can use an amplifier, or you can use a beam antenna. If you'd be satisfied with just local coverage and the use of local repeaters and omni antenna, usually a quarter wave ground plane with good coax mounted 25 or 50 feet above ground will do very well. If you're not planning on working single sideband on either VHF or UHF bands and your mode will be FM, a vertical antenna such as a J-pole, which is my favorite, or a diamond gain antenna will do you just fine. And we can talk about gain antennas in a little more length later on if anybody has any questions about that. Actually, with a gain antenna, you're kind of cheating. You're squishing that donut down to force your signal out horizontally with a vertical antenna. But let me grab a nickel real quick. I'm rabbit trailing here. I do apologize. So if you now want to really reach out and talk with someone, it is time for a beam antenna. Again, with good coax, beams require a rotator, or you could use the hand rotatable beams. Control box in your shack, or if you're out in the woods next to your tent, you can use a hand control. And they come in all kinds of different configurations: 3-element, 5-element, 11-element, 15-element. One of them that I used for a very long time was the HF Mini Quad, which is a combination of a very shortened dipole with a very small quad antenna set up behind it. It's a very small antenna, but worked quite well on 20 through 10 meters. The more elements, the higher the gain of your antenna will be found, and further, the more front-to-back ratio you'll have with more elements. Instead of a Yagi type, cubicle quads have been used as well. The Mini Quad is just a version of it that was designed for HF, and I used to use one of those from the barracks up here in at the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard when I was stationed there. Let me grab a nickel and we'll get on to the next question. Again, this is W4RFJ. Why does a beam give me more bang for the buck? Well, that's a good question, and I'm glad the captain brought it up. A beam is normally made of parasitic elements. These consist of elements called directors and reflectors and the driven element. the combination and the placement of these elements force the radiated signal to go in a specific direction. Further supplies gain in that direction. And that's both transmit and receive. Depending on the number of elements involved, one can gain 8 to 13 or 15 dB of gain. And I've seen some antennas give you up to 20 to 30 dB front-to-back ratio, depending upon, you know, what band you're operating on. So keeping in mind that 3 dB is double your power and 10 dB is times 10. So also this equates, 3 dB equates to 1 S unit on your receiver. So keeping in mind the beam giving you more bang for the buck, the importance of efficiency in your antenna and feed line becomes a big issue with the construction. Assuming that the antenna has been assembled in keeping with commercial standards, we must now make sure that the feed line is of the proper type and connected properly to the antenna with appropriate weatherproofing utilized. Boy, that's putting everything in one paragraph. Let me grab a nickel. The coax is the important thing here. First, it should exhibit the lowest loss possible at your operating frequency, and its power rating will handle what you intend to transmit through it. Consult the coax manufacturer specification on the line you're thinking about using, because some of the examples that should scare you to death would include RG58 and RG8X. These will have a 6 dB loss over 100 feet when used on 2 meters. They are good for HF, though. You can keep that in mind. And double that when used on 440. So you can look at about a 12 dB loss. Depending on the type of coax you use, you can minimize that loss. What this means is that you are losing 75% of your power being transmitted before it even gets to your antenna going through the coax. It further means that you're losing 75% of your incoming received signal before it even reaches the receiver. Some repeater sites have that same issue. That's why they use hardline or waveguide to get those frequencies to the top of the tower and back. Let me grab one more nickel. As a note, RG8 and RG213 have a loss of about 3 dB per 100 feet and 6 dB at 440. 9913 has a loss of 2.1 dB and a half-inch heliax along with 7/8 heliax really starts to look good. I mean, it's well below 2. I'm pretty sure most of those. I'd have to look them up. So when we're talking about an antenna system, I guess one of the big things that I see, especially on marine installations, is providing moisture protection. You know, protection from the weather. So why is moisture protection so important at your connection points? Well, water can be one of your worst enemies within an antenna system. Water that forms across your center conductor and the ground or shield of your coax can form a resistant path that causes a change in your antenna and coax impedance. Did I say impedance? I meant impedance. And this will cause an increase in your SWR. All right, let me grab a nickel here. Boy, this is a long section, Captain. All right, so the importance of height, especially, HF, VHF, UHF, they've got their own, well, let's just put it this way. VHF and UHF, the higher the better, okay? HF, it depends on how you want your signal or how you want your antenna to work. If you want to use it more for local, such as within the United States, you know, putting it closer to the ground will cause the radiation angle to change to bring your signal in closer to you, whereas the higher it goes, the further out it's going to transmit depending upon the angle of the wavefront and propagation. That's a big thing too, but we're talking about the antennas and the height. Okay, so there are three major reasons. One, it keeps ground reflections getting back from getting back into the antenna. Another is the higher the antenna, the lower takeoff angle of radiation will be. And this is something that you want, specifically for distance. Lastly, think about the visual and radio horizon. If a person is 6 feet tall standing at ground level and assuming no buildings or trees or boats are in your way, he or she should be able to see the visual horizon at about 17 miles. If this same person is standing on top of your tower, this horizon is moved further away due to the height of the tower. Now, at VHF and UHF, this is very important. The higher that antenna, the further you can see, the further it's going to talk. And you really don't need a lot of power to do that if your antenna's compensating it, because it's all line of sight when you get into VHF and UHF. Okay, let me grab a nickel. Everything going okay for you there, Captain? I'm just noticing this is getting a little long here.
Yeah, I was listening to you, but I was in the kitchen. No, you're doing fine. Carry on there, Tiger.
All right. Well, the last question, thanks, Captain. The last question here, it says, I understand that higher is better, but what does one do with local restrictions, such as airport restrictions and the like? Well, local restrictions are local restrictions, but there are some things you need to know. If a permit is required, file one. Follow the steps required and construct your tower. Remember that the federal government, the FCC, has mandated that no gated community, local townships, shall restrict an amateur radio operator the right to construct a tower. You can fight for your rights. Don't let these local politicians tell you what you can or cannot do. And I think there's also preemptive rulings that are in the works right now that may be able to help us with, like, the what do they call them, housing authorities or HSAs, I can't remember what they're called. But anyway, the whole point is, and you could keep this in mind, the ARRL has lawyers that volunteer their time to help you with stuff like that. So we kind of, just to summarize a little bit, we talked about antennas, impedance, coax or transmission lines, you know, HF, VHF, UHF, they're all kind of the same. They all deal with the same practical theories as, matching your antenna, you know, getting the signal from one end of that transmission line to the other with minimal attenuation. And if your antenna is set up properly, and I know we're going to be talking about this here in the near future, there should be no issues with getting your antenna to work properly. Now all we got to do is get Mother Nature to work with us with propagation, and we'll have it made. All right, so that's the end of my section, and this section. Let's take some check-ins and see if anybody has any more to add, changes, modifications, complaints. Throw them at Captain. Throw them out there. Suffix only, please. This is W4RFJ with the TIN.
2GA.
And 6, Victor.
And 7-0.
All right, well, I hope we can get some more people in here. One last call. Come on, join us in this conversation. This is W4RFJ. I got a great group here, but I'm hoping to beat Gordon and check-in. So if you guys can help me out, this is W4RFJ. Suffix only, please.
November X-ray India. Better late than never.
Okay, we got you, Mike. All right, we'll stop with that. Let's see. Gary, my long-lost buddy, where you been hiding there, shipmate? 2 Golf Alpha. Go ahead, Gary, W4RFJ. What you got? Oops, I got on key.
Yeah, I have the same problem. It's the first time I've Q-sold on an iPhone. No, I wasn't hiding. I've just been crazy busy, but it's great to be back, that's for sure. Remember, higher is better. So smoke something funny before you put up that dipole. Your signal may not be better, but you really won't care. Anyway, I wanted to comment a little bit about the efficiency of the coax and about the loss, you know, per 100 feet. Oh, by the way, that thing is called the Amateur Radio Parity Act, and I believe that passed to allow us to do antennas in HOA communities. I wanted to talk a little bit about what I've got running here at my installation. What I actually use is one line for both my two-meter 440 J-pole and also for my CHV5X. Now, how does he do that? He does that with a duplexer on one end, and to encode the signal, or to multiplex the signal, and a multiplexer on the other end to demultiplex the signal and split it down between the two antennas. But you're probably saying, my gosh, he probably gets a whole ton of loss on that. Well, I don't. The loss between the duplexers is marginal. It's well below a half a dB. And because I'm using LMR 400 and only 50 feet of it for the transmission line, I really am losing very little in the line to the antenna anyway. So it really does matter what you put between the transmitter and the antenna and antennas. And if you're doing a voodoo setup like that, it's all the more important. Back to you, sir.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Gary, because I did the very same thing in my picking 'em up truck. I got this little 1996 Tacoma pickup truck, and I have a quad band radio that covers 10, 6, 2, and 440, and I'm using duplexers to split off the 10 meters and 6 meters, and the 2 meters and 440 I have going to a dual band Larson up on the roof. So that works quite well, especially if you keep the coax runs to a minimum. All right, next on the list, I think it's Six Victor, the captain himself, and I was just joking about competing for check-ins, by the way.
Oh, I thought I was going to have to get on the roller coaster and get working. Thanks, Rod. KY6V here. Gary, later on, I don't know if it'll be this evening or not, I want to poke a hole at you and say, with all this construction work you told me about that's going on with a house up there, I hope you're getting ready to sell it and move down here to Florida with us. And you can comment on that later. The only reason I jumped in here is your comment about quads, and it sparked an interest, Roger, and a respect. I've always respected and enjoyed using a cubicle quad. When I was out in the islands with the Canoe Club, U.S. Navy, the quads, you know, for 10, 15, and 20 were very plentiful and just a beautiful antenna. And normally, you know, a driven element and a reflector, a two-element quad. I have used with great satisfaction a 2-meter homebrewed two-element quad for direction finding on chasing the bunnies, the hidden transmitter guys. It works like a jewel. So at any rate, thank you for bringing that up. KY6V, go ahead, sir.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, I think you mentioned it earlier, Gordon, the one thing that the cubicle quad does is it gets you closer to a full wave antenna. It's a loop, and each side is a quarter wavelength usually. I have to agree with you. Despite the fact that constructing one can be a little bit of a pain, some of the commercial stuff that they have come up with is pretty neat. All right, next on the list, we'll break with Six Victor and head over to Seven Ocean, the Sheriff of Nottingham. Go ahead, Mr. Slinky.
Well, I just have to make good on that Slinky promise later than that, aren't I? Debbie Forrest-A and the DIN tonight in 070. Thank you, Chief. All right, well, you know, thinking about moisture protection as being, you know, important at antenna connection points, you were both you guys have talked about antenna connection points tonight. When we watch television, we see the guys standing in water, the bad guys standing in water, and they wind up shocking the guy because the water conducts the electricity. But then if water within an antenna system forms a resistant path instead of a conductive path, what causes the difference? And secondly, Chief, now, I'm really throwing this at you in the cold, I know. Second question, Chief, is would you make some comments about RF burns as one works with antenna connections, please? W4FJ, and I'll send a note back to you.
Well, I'll give you a fair warning. Don't work with antennas around me because you probably will get burned. Oh, no, I'm kidding. Look, I can tell you from what I've learned about water and conductivity. Water itself is an insulator. What changes that is the fact that it's so abundant in nature that everything in nature gets into it, and it's the impurities that make it conductive, aka salt. The impurities are what makes it conductive. As a matter of fact, I believe there is a movement to replace halon with water fog, pure H2O, H2O fog in residential / old folks' homes and stuff like that. So water itself is an insulator. And I think I already forgot what the rest of the questions were. It was like three or four in one, wasn't it?
Well, the other major part of the question, now I think you've pretty well covered the big question. The second part of it is, since we're talking about connectors, how about, could you talk some more about RF burns and safety when working with RF connections to antennas? W4FJ and S7O.
Well, I guess the thing that you got to keep in mind is that there is a formula, and I don't have it memorized right off the top of my head, for, you know, radiation, what's it called, radiation, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm at a, well, anyway, there's a formula for the, depending on the frequency, and it's usually the higher frequencies that you have to minimize the amount of power / face time with, because it will, you know, like radar, if you get a beam pointed at you, it'll cook you inside out. But we're talking about, 400 megahertz and above at super high power. So let me grab a nickel. I guess when it comes to RF burns and connections, I haven't really had much experience with that, because when I make a connection, I make sure it's nice and snug. I don't over-tighten it. I make sure it's nice and snug. I take a soft rubber tape and wrap it once with a soft rubber tape, and then I take electrical tape and I tightly wrap that, and then take the end and put a tie wrap around it, a black one, so that it doesn't rot away with UV rays, and that's watertight and won't come loose. So did I answer that question okay? Over.
Absolutely, Chief. Thank you for those reminders. I'm thinking back to quite a few years back in novice days with a few of the surprises, especially when I didn't take the time necessarily to make sure that the people back in the shack needed to be aware of the risk too. So, yes, you answered the question, and thank you very much. Back to you, W4FJ and O7F.
Well, I'm sure I'm glad I didn't have to answer that slinky question you had going. But, yeah, it's exposure, by the way. It's RF exposure. I apologize. I just, that was kind of like caught me by surprise, but that is a big issue, and it's more predominant at the higher frequencies as to being an issue. But you should always calculate it so that you know what that exposure time slash power level should be. All right, so we'll break with the Sheriff of Nottingham. Man, I'm getting to talk to all my good friends tonight. Talk to Gary, talk to Gordon, talk to the Sheriff of Nottingham. Next on the list is NXI, Miguel up there in the frozen country. Come on aboard, W4RFJ with the TIN. We're talking about antennas.
Well, good evening, Roger, and everybody aboard. This is WA1NXI up here in the great state of Maine. Not quite frozen yet, but a little bit chilly. Been burning the wood. Keeping it warm at night and letting it go out in the day, but yeah, great subject, the antennas. Sorry I'm late, I got tied up, but been looking forward to it all week. Not a whole lot to add because I missed so much, but what I heard was interesting. My favorite antenna that I ever had was a little beam. Can't even remember who made it. It was a 33A Junior. But it was an awesome beam. I talked all over the place with that and had a lot of good dipoles and really got into it. And then we moved and we bought this place and the house was nice and really liked the lawn and stuff and never put a lot of thought into the power lines. And that kind of killed OHF for me for now anyway, until I figure out a way to beat the noise. I've tried about everything I could think of. And let me break for a minute. And I know a lot of people will say ground, and it's all about getting a good ground, but I've tried that to eliminate a lot of the noise, and it worked a little bit, but not enough that it makes it worth it to me to be on HF right now. But anyway, great subject. Sorry I'm late, and I'll be listening in. WA1NXI, back to net.
Okay, very good. Well, this has been an awesome information net so far. I've actually learned a few things, and Gordon told me I wasn't trainable. So I'm going to pass back over to Gordon and let him pick up the next section. Gordon, KY6B, it's back to you, sir, W4RFJ.
Well, thank you, sir. I didn't ever say that. Must have been somebody else. Got me confused with somebody. And I was trying to think, I'm very familiar with that antenna, the 33 that you mentioned, Mike, NXI, but I can't remember the manufacturer. The first guess I had was Gutcraft, but I'd have to look that up. I know it wasn't a Mosley and it wasn't a Telex, so Gutcraft for some reason comes to mind. Well, okay, guys and gals, we're going to continue here. You know, we've got 8 segments on the program, and we're only coming up on number 3. We're 57 minutes into the hour. Number 4 will be handled by Roger. And Roger, in the meantime, you might think about this, and what we might do is cut it off halfway through and roll it as a part 2 here, possibly next month or sometime in the future. Okay, let me buy a nickel and we'll continue. KY6V for the South Cars TIN, that's the October TIN. We're going to chin a little more on coax, and it's not that we're trying to beat this through the bush and all of that, but it's a doggone important. I'd like to talk about picking the correct coax in respect to loss and power capability. Some of this has been touched on, but not in a complete manner. We've discussed this already in some degree, as I said, but in doing so again, because it's so important. It is not only the loss in the coax itself, but also the loss in the connectors. One can easily find in a normal installation at least a half of a dB loss in each connector. At VHF and UHF, it is important to use the proper terminating device. Stay away when possible from the PL259. Now, that's the guy that's, prevalent and the choice down on HF, but I'm recommending that you stay away from PL259s and you go to using a Type N or a BNC connector for your needs. Remember to coat your connectors, as Roger has already mentioned, with tape and waterproofing material and so on to keep that permeated water. That isn't in the script. Permeated water, that water that's fouled up with all of this stuff from nature, from doing a number on you. One of the other questions that normally comes across is what makes a one connector better than the other when using this connector at high frequencies, and the answer to that is the simple answer is the better the design, the less capacity. Remember, we were talking about capacity before in the coax. The less capacity. So look at the design specifications for a PL259. Compare that to a Type N or a BNC for VHF and US operation, and you decide yourself. I think it speaks for itself as far as the jury is concerned. Let me buy a nickel. I wanted to touch base again on height consideration, but I'm going to let Roger go ahead in that. He's touched on it pretty well already. And what do you think? We can take a pool here and continue for a while, or we can think about a part two operation. Raj, KY6V, over.
Hey, I vote for a part two personally, Gordon. I got to get up pretty early in the morning. So if we were to cut this off at a part two, I'm for that. Back to you, Gordon.
Okay. I've got some time and can continue. Any comments on that one way or another, or Raj and I will make the decision? Anybody like to speak to the subject?
Oh, man, we just got started.
No, that's because you were late. Was it Cushcraft? Mike, over.
Oh, it could have been. That sounds familiar. But the one that... The one you said you didn't think it was, Mosley or something like that. That sounded real familiar, Gordon. I'd have to look it up, but that was an awesome little beam. And I didn't have it real high, probably only about 35, 40 feet. But on 20 meters, I was in heaven. But yeah, I'd have to look that up, and I will, and bring it back up in part two.
Yeah, okay. What was the full model number on that, Mike? I'm trying to say TA. Was it a Texas Alpha TA-33?
MP-33, I'll bet.
Yeah, I couldn't... Geez, I don't know if it was TA or what it was, Gordon. It was a 33A Junior. They had a 33A that was a bigger beam, I guess, and the junior was a smaller beam. I believe it was three bands. Or I'll have to look it up and dig out my logbook, because I made a lot of good contacts on it, and that was my very first beam. And I think I remember talking to you when it crashed down one winter and got all bent up and stuff. But anyway, I'll look it up and I'll remember more next time.
Yeah, that was a tri-bander. It was 10, 15, and 20. very popular, a good antenna, and very, very popular, as I recall. Well, okay, we have just made a command decision here that we're going to call it short here shortly. Now, that really doesn't rhyme together very well. We're going to call it short shortly. I'm going to let Roger go ahead with the any other comments on height considerations, and then we'll get ready to find the fat lady and have her sing. Go ahead, Roger, KY6V.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gordon. And, Mike, it's the MP33 Alpha Junior is a Mosley antenna. I had one, and I just found a used one that I'm going to purchase here as soon as I save up my allowance. I want to get my portable tower out at the camper, and I want to get a nice tri-bander up above it. And I think that Mosley will work out quite well. So, let me grab a nickel, and we'll get into height considerations, and then we'll pass it on to the young sunshiny lady to close it up. This is W4RFJ. Okay, so when we talk about height considerations, we'd like to emphasize the importance of height. On VHF, UHF, height greatly increases your coverage area. As you guys are probably already aware, your UHF and your VHF don't bounce off the ionosphere like HF signals do. So you're basically resigned to line of sight. If your antennas can't see each other, they can't talk to each other. So that's the best way. One, the height gets you above ground obstacles in many cases and creates direct line communication as necessary at these frequencies. So a common question is, I understand the radio horizon, but what causes skip conditions at VHF and UHF frequencies? Well, the answer is atmospheric conditions. You can get low pressure fronts, high pressure fronts, cloud formations, cooling, heating of the atmosphere, refractions of RF energy off these substances, dogs and cats living together. I mean, you name it. There's, okay, I'm trying to be funny, but I know I'm probably putting everybody to sleep. I've actually witnessed a temperature or a low pressure or high pressure front. I can't remember which one it was. All I know is that the hot air was going up and the cold air was going down, and it created this perfect waveguide. It created a waveguide can greatly increase the distance that you talk. Let's see. I think that's about it. I guess I'll pass it over to, wait a minute, should I take check-ins? Let's take check-ins to talk about that for a little bit. This is W4RFJ. Do we have anybody with comments about height considerations? Over, under.
KC2GA.
Hey, Gary. Let me see if anybody else wants to get in. Okay, I guess not. Gary, pick it up. I'll tell you what, that day that I came across that waveguide thingy with the atmosphere, I was talking between Virginia Beach, Virginia, and New York City, and I was actually controlling the net of people driving around the Beltway around Washington, D.C. How do you like that? Go ahead.
I like that. KC2GA here. Actually, that's exactly what I was going to comment on last year. I think it was late January or early February. There was a weather type of an inversion type of a thing, and it opened up 6 meters. It was like a pipeline to South America. We were working here, you know, in Syracuse. We were working stations in South America like they were local, and it held up for a while. It wasn't just some
some little 15-minute deal. This was all day. I mean, it was, you know, it was almost freaky after a point. You know, it was like it was too good. But very, very cool. So, yeah, it's going to vary. Of course, 6 meters, you know, the magic band, right? You know, the magic happens and you never know. But, you know, it's going to vary by band. It's going to vary with screwy things like weather inversions and all kinds of stuff. But that's where propagation plays into the whole thing. But, you know, no matter how propagation is, whether it's good or bad, you know, you got to have your antenna straight to get the most out of it. You know, you're gonna get the most out of a bad propagation day, and you're going to get the most out of a good propagation day. Back to you. This is KC2, GA.
Oh, thank you, Gary. Yeah. You know, what's funny is I was living in Virginia Beach. I had an antenna that was like, it was on 2 meters, and I had an antenna about 15 feet off the ground because I was right in the final path of Oceania's Naval Air Station, of their runway, so I couldn't have anything very high. As a matter of fact, the antenna was lower than the second-story roof of the building. So I ended up net controlling as soon as everybody found out I had just gotten my upgrade to general from novice to general. So that was pretty neat. I ended up being net control for the entire northeastern seaboard. That is really a neat thing to happen. And on 10 meters, believe it or not, 10 meters, I've actually been talking to a guy locally and then have another group of guys coming in, and I look outside, and between me and them is a cloud, and as the cloud drifted away, they drifted away. So anybody else want to join in on comments about antenna height? Please call W4RFJ. If not, we'll get Miss Sunshine in there to brighten our evening. Okay, hearing none. Gordon, I look forward to the second round, and I'm assuming that you're going to head that off being first in line on that one too, because I'm really looking forward to hearing your take on SWR and so forth. So I will pass it over to KY6V, or I guess Case Miss Sunshine. I'm not sure who wants to pick it up, but I'm done. W4RFJ, I got to go to bed. If you feel the ground move, that's me hitting it.
Okay. Thanks, Raj, very much. And thanks to all that joined us here this evening. Kathy says, no way. She's headed for bed, too. She's got an early morning in the morning with a teaching job and so on and so forth. So I'll close it out here momentarily. Talk about propagation, you guys. Gary and Roger reminds me of a story. I came out of the CBS television transmitter building one evening. I don't know, it was 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, and I jumped in the car to head home. I turned on the 2-meter rig, and I didn't have anything fancy. I had a little 25-watt rig in the car and a Larson 5H mag mount on the top of the automobile, and we used a lot of 146.52 down there. So I turned it on. I didn't hear anything, so I grabbed the microphone. I said, anybody around? And this voice comes back and says, yeah, I'm here. It was a W-2 in New York City. I said, say what? Do you want to know where I am? He says, yeah. I says, well, I happen to be down here south of Miami in southern Florida. He says, really? We talked back and forth for 20 minutes. It was about a 20-minute ride for me to get from the station to the house. And just had a ball. Just absolute ball. Well, guys and gals, let's see. Let me buy a nickel. We've got some interesting stuff to still cover, and SWR is one that we're going to hit pretty hard. How to read it, what's it's all about, what creates it, how to get rid of it. And really, the important part when we get into that is how to read it. And it's not reading what the meter says on the front. It's where you put the SWR bridge to start with. But we'll get into that. I'll leave you hang on that one. George, can the Slinkies wait until next month, or do you want to pose it now? N070, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Gordon. Well, I think that was a good teaser for next month because it's really tied into SWR, and for those who have limited space like myself, seems like a Slinky is worth more than just a quick comment. So we'll do it next time, and maybe that will give people incentive to tune in to the next TIN. Thank you, Gordon. KY6V, NO70.
Okay, very good. Incidentally, George, it looks like everything has been solid on my recording, or recordings, plural. So just hold on to yours up there, and if I have any trouble in the editing department, I'll yell in your direction. But thanks for doing that. Okay, any other comments? Anything for the good of the order before we close down this evening? Please call Gordon, KY6V, over. Okay, we're going to say hasta la bye-bye, and that's how they talk down there in Miami. This has been SCARS, VOIP, and net schedules and general information may be found on our SCARSVOIP.com website. That's SCARVOIP.com. We'll see about scheduling part two of antennas probably whenever the third, I guess I could look that up, the third of November might be, and it looks like it would be the 16th. That's 2 days after Gary's birthday. His birthday is on November 14th. He ought to be partied out by then. Maybe we'll have him get in here and run as part of the presentation. Good night, everybody. We're going to return the server back to normal use and abuse. And have a great evening. We'll see you guys down the path. KY6V and SouthCars, TIN October is now clear.